up, everybody? Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Ricky Grandis. I just did an amazing show with Dr. Darsha Narvaez, professor of psychology of Notre Dame. She's written a bunch of books on ethics and neurobiology, development of human morality, evolution, culture. I mean, so much. But this podcast was really interesting and important for me, a podcast I think all parents should listen to. We hit on so many topics and issues that every parent has to deal with, like, can you hold your kid too much? Should you let them cry it out? You know, all the science and research behind the pros and cons of all these modern ways of parenting we have. And we talk about so many things that I don't want to ruin it by doing a big intro and telling you all the topics. Listen to the show. We hit on about every single topic and issue you have as a parent and all the important decisions we have to make as parents on how to handle things. So I think it will be very informative, very helpful to a lot of people. I know I learned a lot from this show. And if you're interested in her work, like I always tell you guys on our YouTube channel, in the show descriptions, I always put links to our guests' website, their books, any videos, anything that's a link to them, a Facebook page, Twitter, and you can dive into more of her work. She's written tons of books, articles, popular blog posts, and so look into that. And also, if you like the show, rate the show. Go on iTunes or wherever you listen to the show, rate it, give it a whatever star rating you think it deserves, and write a review. It helps people find it, and more likely that service, iTunes or Stitcher or whatever, will recommend this podcast to other people. So please do that. Also, subscribe to us on YouTube and find us on Facebook, on our Facebook page, the Ripple Effect Podcast Facebook page, and you can friend request me if you see me on there. You can friend request me if you're a fan of the show, which I know a lot of people have, which is completely cool with me, and it's always cool to kind of get to know the listeners and stuff. And also follow me on Twitter at RVTheory6. So do all that. Thanks again, guys. Have a great New Year's, and I hope to have many more shows to come in January and February, and hopefully it'll be, you know, we just finished a great year of the Ripple Effect Podcast. I had some amazing guests this year, and I really can't thank everybody enough who listens and consistently downloads and subscribes and all that stuff. And it's always amazing, no matter how much time I take off from doing this, you know, if it's a week or if it's 4 weeks or a month, I come back, I release the show randomly, and people are downloading and listening again. So it's awesome that you guys appreciate my work and you appreciate the work I put into these booking these guests and getting interesting people, and which really I shouldn't get too much credit for because it's fun. This show is a perfect example of it. It's awesome that I get to share these really interesting people with listeners who might not be familiar with their work and share these really interesting conversations and have these conversations because, like I always say, I hope the listeners get something out of the show, but I know I definitely am, and that definitely makes it worth doing and continuing. So I'm having a blast doing this. I'm definitely growing and becoming a little bit more knowledgeable throughout this whole process and growing as a person. So thanks again, guys. Have a great holiday and New Year's, and I'll see you in 2017 if I don't do one before. Thanks, guys. Peace. Thanks for being with me. This is a really exciting show. I'm a huge fan of trying to figure out how we can make our lives actually more natural, I guess, because I think a lot of parts of our lives have become less and less natural, and I know we're adaptive creatures, but that when I heard you on Christopher Ryan's podcast, it was interesting because he has a book that he's working on called Civilize the Death, and it's always a really interesting topic, this idea of, like, what is progression, and are we really progressing as people? Are we getting detached from things that you know, are better for us, and we think we're going in the right direction and we might not be. And when you look at modern medicine, when you look at, you know, the type of foods we're eating, and it just seems like there's a lot of things that are moving quicker than the human body can adapt to. And I think parenting's very similar. You know, I remember when we had, I don't know if it was our son. I have a almost two. He's going to be two in February, a son. And then I have a daughter who's 4 months yesterday. And so sleep is definitely not in in my schedule. But I remember the doctor saying how there's nothing, you know, we're struggling with the birth, and the doctor's like, you know, there's nothing natural about this anymore. She kind of just came out of nowhere and said it. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, I'm like, she's absolutely right. There's, you know, you give a mother drugs, and then, you know, you a lot of times they try to, it seems like with my experience and my research, what I found was that C-sections are much more likely than they used to be, and not necessarily because of health reasons, but it seems like convenience reasons. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but it seems like that's much more. I mean, even with our situation, and I promise I'll let you talk eventually. I have a habit of going on these rants. It's a topic that I'm very passionate about, because I think that parenting is one of the most important things we could possibly do, developing the future of this world and how they perceive things. And kids are such a clean slate. You know, they have no understanding of how the world works, and everything that they learn throughout, you know, their growing years is all things that we're giving to them, and their input that they're getting from us. And as parents, we try to do our best to, you know, mess up them as little as possible, because we're probably going to make mistakes along the way, but we'll, you know, we do our best to try to make as little mistakes as possible. So when I heard you on Christopher Ryan's podcast, it was awesome, because it was exactly what I was looking for in doing reading and researching, was this idea of what modern parenting, the mistakes we make, and all these myths on, you know, it's okay to let a kid cry, you know, oh, you can hold a kid too much, and all these things. So, you know, so thank you for being with me, and I'm can't wait to get into all these topics.
Sounds good. Yep. I agree with a lot of your inclinations there.
So how did you get involved in this? Because you were initially a music teacher, and you traveled all over the world in many different Spanish-speaking countries. And I know you spent some time in my neighboring country of my home country of Portugal. You were in Spain for a while. And so you saw a lot of different cultures, a lot of different, I'm guessing a lot of different ways of also raising kids and educational systems and different ways of parenting. How did you go from that into this field of work?
Well, that's kind of a long story. I'm in my seventh career.
Yeah.
I'll just say, I don't know if you don't want to go into all that detail, but I can just say that since I was a little kid, I have been concerned about other little kids. And it just took me a while to get back to looking at it, or actually to get to looking at it in a social science kind of way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And one thing you said too, that I remember hearing you say in an interview, which I think is very true, is, you know, I think you talked, well, at the time of the interview, you talked about not having any children, right?
Right.
And you talked about how that actually benefits you, because you let the research, or you let, you know, the information that you gather affect your opinion, and not so much your own personal experiences. Because a lot of times, you know, and we'll talk to, you know, we have a lot of, I'm at that age, you know, in my early 30s, where a lot of my friends are having kids, and you know, they're doing things differently than other parents. And whatever they decide to do, whatever their life choices are, ends up dictating their opinion. So if they're, you know, if they didn't breastfeed, then they'll look up all the information that says that, you know, there's not a whole lot of benefits in breastfeeding, so they gave formula. If they decide to do this, you know, this way of parenting, then they'll, you know, they'll be a defender of that method, whatever method they go ahead with. So you almost have this you know, you can look at everything as just information and just gather it without having a biasness, because there is a lot of that. You know, if you have a parent that disciplines, you know, by spanking, then that parent will say it's okay to spank, and, you know, this and that, and then you know, and vice versa. So I think you're actually, you know, you're probably very much, you know, have a benefit in you know, not having kids. Obviously, I'm, you know, I'm not sure if it just happened that way or whatnot, but in your case, being in this research or doing this research and you know, all this work, and you know, I wonder if even myself at times, you know, the way I handle things, am I looking for information to back the way I handle things, you know, and am I really looking at everything from a clean slate? So I think there is absolutely there's a benefit to that.
Yeah. Well, I've comforted myself with that idea now. So because I really wanted, when I was in junior high, I wanted 20 kids. So, and I was going to do everything for them and with them and all that, and just never worked out for all sorts of twists and turns in my life and various physiological things. So anyway, here I am, and I've always had this deep concern for babies and young children, especially. And ethics and morality, and what's flourishing, what does optimization look like? I've already always had that kind of orientation. And so now I can look at it and look at what really should be our baselines for raising children without having that self-interest, right, of defending what I decided myself as a parent. So I think it is a good thing now.
What do you think are some of the first mistakes that, you know, what are some of the first mistakes parents do? Like, I mean, in regards to even when the before birth, I mean, even just having the baby grow in the mother and all that stuff, you know, I always had this thing where it's kind of weird. It was a personal experience that kind of affected the way I parented, that because I'm actually a twin, and I remember for some weird reason, I don't remember specifics, but I remember my mother being stressed all the time. And I remember as I got older, asking her about it, I'm like, hey, dude, I'm like, was there a lot of stress? I mean, did you not have a lot of help when we're real little or whatever? And she would say you know, she's like, well, you know, it was twins. And she's like, it was a lot for me to handle. So, yeah, sometimes I would lose my temper, this and that. And I'm like, you know, it's crazy because, you know, there's later in life, there's more specific times where I remember her, you know, losing her cool because she had two kids that she had to take care of who probably weren't behaving that well. But, you know, I even remember, even at a younger age, where I don't remember specifics, but I remember the feeling of anxiety or anger in the room. And I told myself, I'm like, you know, when I have kids, I'm going to do my best to never, you know, let stress or never to show that stress. And, you know, it's amazing how kids seem to have some understanding of social cues, you know, that sometimes adults don't pick up on, you know, and they seem to know when you're angry or they, you know, and there's all this just, I guess, physical hints that they're getting. And, you know, is that something that I'm just kind of making up, this idea that even when the mother is still, you know, the kids the child's developing in the stomach, is, I mean, even stress, is that a huge, does the stress that you avoid, is that a benefit later in life, or does it not really have a real effect until maybe after birth? Or what's your opinions on that?
Well, the research shows that it does matter. So when the mother is stressed, no matter what time period of the gestation in the womb, no matter how old that fetus is, that stress will affect the baby after birth, and they'll be more irritable in general, which means they're more difficult to take care of easily. So it does have long-term effects. We have that pretty established with lots of different studies. So yeah, I think stress is a big deal. And we've I don't know why, in the USA, we somehow decided it's fine to stress families and kids to the nth degree. See how much stress we can get away with on them and still have people that function. So it's really a crazy, upside-down, topsy-turvy world we've created for children and families in the United States. We need family leave so that parents can actually attend to their kids without being distressed about getting to work and you know, not, they don't breastfeed because they have to go back to work in a few weeks after birth. I mean, that's crazy stuff, because these effects, being responsive to the needs of the child, breastfeeding, they have long-term, lifelong effects on the well-being of that child, their intelligence, their social capacities, their emotional intelligence. All sorts of things are affected in those first, in the womb, but also in the first months and years of life. I can talk to you about what we call the evolved nest, which has these characteristics that are really millions of years old, that we used to provide children as human beings, but we in civilized nations have moved farther and farther away from them. And especially in the USA in the last century, And it's having detrimental effects on health and well-being for all ages now. I think we can probably link these things directly to the health deterioration we have across the country. Do you want me to go through that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right. So, I can expand this NEST characteristics broader or narrower, and I'll broaden it a little bit by including that early preparation when the baby is in the womb of having the mother who is supported by her family, the community, so she feels calm most of the time, because that's going to affect the way the baby is developing. And then she needs that support after birth too. We are meant and have evolved to need others as mothers, we call them allo mothers, to help the birth mother care for that baby well. And evidence from studies with other animals and with human mothers that if they don't feel supported by the community, they're not going to be as responsive to the needs of that child, which is detrimental for that child in the long term, because their brain just doesn't develop as well when they're stressed or when they're ignored or when they're abused or neglected. So supportiveness when the mother's pregnant, supportiveness of the community after birth and through the life of that child is really important for the well-being and normal optimal development of the child. So that's one thing. Another thing is the soothing perinatal experiences. That means you don't separate the mother and baby at birth. That's done routinely in most hospitals in the USA. That, you know, can trigger depression in both of them because they're separated. And we've got postpartum depression epidemic in our society right now. The mothers get depressed and then they aren't very responsive to their babies because they're depressed. And then the baby's depressed and, you know, they just don't get along.
And do you know what the increase of that is? Because it does seem like it's more common now than before.
I don't know. I don't have the figures. I should know that. It has increased. I just don't know specifically.
Do you have a hunch on what your opinion might be on what you think might be causing that? Obviously, the separation is definitely probably one aspect of it, right?
Right. And then the lack of breastfeeding. So under normal, natural birth conditions, the baby emerges, the baby triggers the birth by signaling to the mom's body that they're kind of ready to come. And so if you schedule a birth with a cesarean or you induce the birth with Pitocin, you're undermining that baby's, you know, kind of agency to be born. So there probably is an effect there. And flooding the mother's body with Pitocin, which is artificial oxytocin, also probably there's suspicion that that undermines the baby's own oxytocin systems and then suppresses that. And the oxytocin hormone is the cuddle hormone, it's called often, you know, it makes you feel good and at ease and all this. So there's a lot of physiological things that get messed up when you mess up the timing of that baby's birth. And so having it, so in a way that's traumatic to force the baby into the world before they're ready. And then the other things we do at birth, besides that separation, is painful procedures of various kinds, you know, sticking the baby's foot with a needle or a pin, or, you know, giving them vaccines or circumcision, all sorts of weird things, scrubbing them harshly, putting things in their eyes for gonorrhea, even though there's no reason to have gonorrhea, concern for it. So there's a lot of procedures that were developed decades ago when they thought babies didn't feel anything, but they do.
Yeah, and so even circumcision, right? They've done studies that prove that, you know, sometimes they don't cry because they're in so much pain, they don't.
They're in shock.
Yeah, they're in shock. Yeah, yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. Yeah.
So the mother not breastfeeding. So let me just say that there's a baby-friendly hospital initiative now that the USA has finally gotten on board on in 2011. At that time, so baby-friendly means mostly breastfeeding supportive. So they don't separate the mom. There's 10 principles. They don't separate the mom and baby at birth. They don't give the baby formula or sugar water, which happens routinely in the other hospitals. They help the mother with breastfeeding, that kind of thing. The baby-friendly hospital initiative then which has been around since the 90s, and Sweden changed all their hospitals at that time, but it took us till 2011 to get going on it here. I think now we have maybe 15% of hospitals in the country, in the USA, are baby friendly. and so that there's something there of following the rhythms of the mother and the baby's bodies, you know, their relationship, that first hour after birth, there seems to be some magical quality to it, of bonding that occurs. So the mom to mom, a mom to baby skin on skin contact is really important. That's part of baby friendly. Some of the baby friendly hospitals, what they do now. And so I think if you don't follow those normal, natural things, you're at a risk factor for, I think, depression and all sorts of other problems. They've done animal studies where they just separate a horse or a pig baby from its mother for an hour after birth, and then they watch it long term, and they find out that when they become an adolescent, they're kind of messed up. They don't get along very well. They have trouble with self-control, things like that. And that's just an hour, 1 hour of separation. We're separating kids from their moms for hours on end, days on end, months on end now. And it's just an experiment we're doing, which is kind of not very smart.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of ways depression can come in for mom and baby.
Yeah, it's crazy how detached we've been from, and I feel like a little bit, you know, pediatricians and stuff will just stress out parents because parents want to do the right thing. They want to do what's best for their child. They want to believe they're doing the best thing for their child. So, you know, that means, you know, you're stressing about, you know, oh, he should know 10 words by the time he's two. He shouldn't be able to do this and he should be able to do that and all these milestones. What's your opinion on parents stressing about those milestones? How important are they in the long-term development of the child? You know, is there any research that actually proves that when they don't hit these milestones as an adult, they're less likely to be intelligent or successful or whatever?
Yeah, I think it depends on which milestones you're talking about. I would be less concerned that right now there's this super emphasis on cognitive stuff, you know, knowing words and language and you know, going into preschools and teaching them how to write letters and things like that. Very, very bad idea, because that's not what's developing maturationally. The brain isn't oriented that way before age 6 or 7, or for some kids 10 or 11. And every child is different. So to make these rules about what's supposed to happen is a problem. And then what's really important in the first years of life is the social development, the emotional development. And that will go well if you carry the baby around a lot with you and look them in the eye a lot and play games and back and forth and goo goo gaga kind of stuff. That's just going to happen normally. Now, it's we've run into problems now because there are a lot of parents that put their kids in strollers or in carriers and they don't hold them very much. They're told to put them into cribs and sleep alone, and all those things are pushing away that social emotion development, undermining it, because the baby, the young child, really needs to be next to the caregiver virtually all the time. And in the same one, the mom, to be intimately known by the mother, and then eventually the father as well, and other caregivers that really are usually related to that child. But what we do is we send babies to, you know, hang out with strangers who are overwhelmed with a bunch of other babies. And so the child is put into almost a prison isolation or solitary confinement in terms of social emotional development. And then we wonder why they have trouble with school, or why they're not very, you know, smart getting along with others, or, you know. So all these problems, we've sort of set ourselves up for these problems. We shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, because one thing you talked about that I think is really interesting, you know, being born in Portugal and knowing, you know, a lot of European countries, that, you know, you have kids you give birth, the mother and father has a significant amount of time off to spend time, you know, as a family and develop. And it's, you know, that's so important. In America, it's not mandatory. And it's, to me, it just seems like, you know, we're much more concerned about careers. You know, I have friends of mine who and people I know who they'll tell you how much they love their kids, but they work 80 hours a week and they kiss them at night when they go to bed. And that's about, you know, all the interaction they have with their kids Monday through Friday. And to me, it's like, you know, that child's going to be much happier if you're around more than if you make that extra, you know, whatever, a week to buy that bigger house or to buy them the more expensive present. I always say on this show how we can learn a lot from children in regards to, you know, when you look at children, you can buy them the most expensive toy, but they forget about that and they move on. But what they really want, what really makes them happy, is having people they love around them and playing with them. And they don't care how big the house is that they're playing in or how small the house is. You know, I always use the example, there's plenty of parents and children who have amazing love for one another and amazing relationships, and they grew up poor. So, I mean, so you think, you know, you're being a good parent by focusing on, you know, maybe making more money to give them nicer things, but really all they want is your time. And do you think that's just an issue because of the way we look at, you know, I mean, in America, we have this idea where, you know, everybody comes here, you know, a lot of immigrants like my parents and myself, because I was born in Portugal. We come here to try to financially get ahead, that we kind of lose some of, you know, the roots of, you know, what made parenting different. You know, we focus so much on that goal of making more money that we kind of lose a lot of other things.
Yeah, it seems to be the case, because the more the second generation, third generation folks that are here, they turn into becoming more materialistic, and their kids have more problems. So there seems to be some truth to that. I don't know the specifics on the data, though. But I think the culture that you're in makes you focus on whatever that culture thinks is important. So it's really important to pick and select the kind of cultural, whatever, messages that you attend to. So the people who have a better time with this are those who are isolate themselves from the materialistic kind of commercialized way of living that is dominant in the country. So people like in the Amish community, perhaps, they don't watch TV, or places where they, you know, have regular community support systems that are set up, and moms don't have to go to work, which we've now assumed is normal that they have to. So those kinds of societies, I think, or communities are better off in terms of child development. Of course, there's other things to worry about in an isolated community, but in terms of what's healthy for that child's brain development, for their neurobiological development of how all their systems work, it's better to have mom at home. It's better to have dad very attentive as well, and to have an extended family or community members that are there to support the mom and child so that they're not isolated in the house all by themselves, which is also a crazy kind of thing, which is recent in the human history.
Yeah, because before, I mean, a lot of times, and I've heard Christopher Ryan even talk about this, how, you know, the community would raise the child, right? You know, it wouldn't be just the responsibility of the mother, you know. Or now you see a lot more hands-on fathers. You know, there's times where I'm changing diapers or doing whatever, and people are like, oh, wow, my husband didn't do that, you know. And you start seeing a little more of that. It seems like there is a positive change in regards to that.
Yeah.
But, you know, is that a huge difference where now it's like, you know, basically only your parents raise you, and before it was more of a community, so everybody helped you? And I wonder if that contributed to even like how stressful, because you think about it, like my parents, my mother's one of seven, my dad's one of 12. I mean, these were, you know, not families compared to modern families. These were small armies, you know. So it's crazy to think how stressful, you know, two kids can be in my position, you know, having two children, to having 12 or seven seem insane. But, you know, you talk to people who grew up in those households, and it's like the older siblings helped raise the smaller ones, and you had uncles and aunts, and everybody kind of contribute. Is that something that we're missing? Could that be also a contributing factor to why parents today feel like, you know, being a parent or having kids is so stressful? And, you know, you might have one and think like, I can't handle having two, or I have two and I can't handle having three, because it's almost like everything is put on the parents and you don't have that community to help out and to contribute to the raising of the children.
Yes, I agree with you. Yeah, we sort of have forgotten that, and we expect then, we put all these things on mothers, just like we do with teachers. We expect them to do everything in the world. Now we expect moms and dads to do everything themselves, which is kind of a crazy thing. No wonder they feel stressed and parenting is not very pleasant. In the past, it used to be fun to have a child and you loved doing it because you had all the support, right? It wasn't all on your shoulders. So it's not a good sign for the species that parenting is becoming so onerous.
And in regards to, we briefly talked about like holding the kid. My son, like, he is super attached to me and he constantly wants me to hold him. And, you know, I'll have other people say, oh, you know, he shouldn't get too used to that. I mean, is there any?
Why not?
That's my point. Yeah. I mean, like the way I, you know, my response is always like, listen, eventually I know one day will come where he doesn't want me to hold him. He actually doesn't even want to talk to me. So, you know, I'm going to milk it as long as
13,
I can.
14.
Yeah. You know, I'm like, eventually he's not even going to want to hang out with his parents. So I'm like, you know what? You know, I'm going to milk it as long as I can. I'm not going to complain about it. You know, so, but is there any?
Yes. There's lots of evidence for the importance of touch, positive touch and affection. And it seems from brain development research that's been done on neglected kids that boys are much more affected by not getting their needs met in early life than girls because of the way their brain is shaped at birth. And then so if your child, your boy especially, wants to be held and cuddled, do it. You know, just give them all the love you can. That's great because that's helping them grow right then. When you separate a mammal baby from their mother, usually it's mother, they stop growing as much. They slow down on DNA synthesis and growth hormone. And so there are real effects when you separate that child. It's just a bad idea. And then spanking them and punishing them, that's a bad idea too. There's research on that showing long-term negative effects there. So positive touch is another part of that nest. Lots of affection. The baby should be carried around virtually all the time in the first year or so, 2 years, probably three even. You're really a baby until about age three. So, and we are born really immature compared to other apes or hominids. We should be in the womb at least another 18 months, which means our brain is really affected by everything that happens to us after birth. And part of that needs to be more like an external womb experience, where you're kept calm and cuddled and loved and feeling great while all those brain systems are finishing themselves. Because if you overstress the baby and during that time period, their stress response will get messed up and they'll be more easily agitated or thrown into anxiety or depression if you don't keep them calm during that time period.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've looked into it, but I remember seeing studies about how children, you know, babies, you know, the first couple years of their lives, how, you know, a ape or whatever type of a animal it was that was actually smarter than the human. But I guess what made us different was our social skills, right? That's what kind of made.
Yeah.
So I guess that kind of proves your point that, it, you know, it's really important to focus on those social skills of you know, loving and laughing and playing and all that type of stuff. And, you know, you talked about spanking. You know, I have this thing where, you know, my parents are old school. I got spanked as a child. I don't blame them because I'm sure they got spanked much more as a child and you know, and they're probably doing a better job than what their parents did. But, you know, in regards to that, you know, when you have parents that say, you know, I've had conversations with friends of mine who have kids and they'll say, you know what, you think you're not going to spank, but you'll see, you have to do something because they'll be out of control or whatever. You have to show them some type of discipline. What's your opinion on that? What's your advice on how to handle a child when they misbehave? You know, what's other alternative methods, you know, on all that?
Well, if you are giving that child what they need from the beginning, they're going to be very compliant and cooperative. And if you're not sending them off to daycare for hours a day, they're going to, and you're hanging out with them in a responsive way, they're going to be cooperative. You're not going to have this problem. So part of the issue of spanking is we've got a number of the long history of that parent-child relationship that's coming into play there. So if the child is being disobedient, you first have to ask yourself, well, what is it I want that child to do? And are they capable at this moment in their development to do that? often parents have these high expectations for like a 2 or 3 year old, which are unrealistic. That's not what they can do at that age. Or they think the babies, you know, are manipulating them when they cry, which is ridiculous. The baby can't do that yet.
Pretty young. I mean, it seems like even my son, for example, they pick things up so quickly. He was, I mean, at a pretty young age, you know, if he coughed or something like that while eating, or we thought he was choking, we would run at him and we'd make sure he was okay. And then he picked up that every time he coughed, we would go make sure he's okay. So then he would fake cough. It was adorable. We would laugh, and it was so obviously fake.
Game. For him, it's a game.
Yeah. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. It does not necessarily mean that he's trying to take advantage of us or whatnot. But kids do those type of things where it seems like, you know, my son, when he, you know, if we wanted him to, if he wanted something, we didn't give him it immediately, he would whine or whatever. And then the second you give it to him, he would stop. And you're like, oh, he wasn't really crying. He was just pretending he was crying. Like, you know, is the only option just giving him what he wants immediately all the time? Do we ever say no?
Yeah. You got to be careful. So when I talk about baby needs, what I talk about is you don't want the baby to cry. And that's under age 18 months or so, or maybe 12 months. It depends on the kid. But you want to move in to make them comfortable when they're just a few months old. When they start to make a face or start to wiggle, that's a sign they need something. And that's when you move in, because that's keeping those systems calm while they're finishing themselves. They need you to self-regulate. They can't do it on their own. Once baby starts to cry, they have a hard time in those early months stopping, because they haven't developed the mechanisms to stop crying. And so you want to prevent it from happening at all. And we see this in small band hunter-gatherer communities. That's the kind of society in which humanity spent 99% of its existence. And they provide this nest that I haven't finished talking about yet. But and they will immediately, if they're a young baby makes a sound, all the adults will say, pick up the baby, pick up the baby. Because you want to keep the baby calm and quiet, because they can get off on this rant and you can't control it, right? And that's very dangerous when you're living outdoors with predators and things. So our history is to keep babies quiet. Now, there is a time period when they do learn manipulation, you know, age 2.5, 3, but this is the time when they're testing out their autonomy, their strength, their can-do-it-ness. And you want to let them do that as much as possible. They're probably the least pro-social at this time. They're more, you know, want to show that they can do something, you know, and will run at someone with a stick. In these small band hunter-gatherer communities, they make a game out of it. They know the child isn't a human being yet. They're still growing into being a human being. And so, you know, they play and they forgive and they don't punish. There's no punishment in these societies. Because if you start to punish a child for doing something that seems inappropriate, you're now focusing their attention on themselves. And what you want to do instead is to focus their attention on the other people. If they're under age 3, they probably can't understand anyway too much about hurting other people. But with age, older kids, you want to focus their poor behavior on the effects that they've had on other people. Well, think about how your sister's feeling now. You took her toy. You know, is that something you want to make her feel? You know, and that kind of thing, to get them imagining living in the shoes of the other. So there's a bunch of different things. It depends on the age. It's hard to make generalizations here, except keep the baby calm when they're very young. And give them what they need, which is lots of holding and comforting and rocking and wiggling and playful back and forth eye contact, you know, build their social skills. And you'll have much less problem. Terrible twos don't exist in many societies. People come here, immigrants come, and they say, what's terrible twos? I've never heard of that, coming from Latin America, for example, or from indigenous societies. But that's what happens. You get terrible twos when you deny kids what they need from the beginning, leaving them alone in their cribs, letting them cry, giving them formula. Everything gets kind of dysregulated. And then, you know, when they get into their, well, I call it autonomy surge, they have a surge of wanting to try things out at age 2 and also age 13 or so. And then when they get into that surge, they don't have this sense of empathy for others that you would otherwise develop. And so then they get kind of mean-spirited. And if they don't have a proper community support to shift them into being more oriented to helping others and being pro-social, they might stay in that kind of self, you know, aggrandizing way of being, which unfortunately I think is a common problem in the USA.
Huh. That's interesting. In regards to like sleeping, so, you know, I just had a conversation actually yesterday with a friend of mine talking about, he has two kids roughly around the same age as mine, a little older, but he was talking about how his wife read this book, Save Our Sleep, and he was referring me to it. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but he was talking about how he gets his kids to sleep from 7 to 7 every day. And it sounds like, I mean, it sounds like heaven from a parent's perspective, you know, but is there something unnatural about that? You know, trying to get them to sleep on the same schedule all the time. Is there something, is there any benefits or disadvantages of doing things like that? Are you unnaturally trying to get your kid to sleep when maybe he's not tired? I mean, is there any research that talks about that?
Well, this is a really tough area because the research that's done is usually very poorly done and misleading. So, even in the journal Pediatrics, they will publish studies that are just terrible. It would never get published in a psychology journal, and I could say more about that. But speaking in general, what's natural for human beings, if you go back to these small band hunter-gatherer communities, which provide that nest of support, nobody sleeps by themselves. They sleep really wherever they get tired, they fall asleep. And often in piles of people, really, not in straight lines, for example. But they are living outside, and so they follow the sun. And they're up with the sun, and they go to bed with the sun. And that changes during the seasons, how long that is that they're up or asleep. So it is a different lifestyle. Now we come to our lifestyle where we have lights on at night, which kind of mess up the circadian rhythms. So you don't want to have your child exposed to bright light in the evening. And that includes televisions and computers and things, to get their circadian rhythms to bring them into sleepiness, right? And then being up with the sun is kind of a normal human thing to do. So you have a lot of variables now that are really hard to manage, I think, especially if you're working. That's, again, why we need the parental leave, so you don't have to worry about getting your sleep at night. You can have naps with the kids during the day if needed. And, you know, if you have parental leave, you have the option of doing that. So we're kind of in a messy spot now. If you're going to use cry it out techniques, and that means cry, usually it's referring to crying to extinction. So you leave a baby alone until they stop crying. And you assume then that they fell asleep and that they're fine. And boy, you feel better because your stress levels have gone down as a parent. But the research shows that the stress level of the baby that's left is still very high. They just learned not to talk to you. They've learned to lose faith that you'll ever help them. So it's really a very damaging approach to sleep training, that extreme cry it out technique. I write about that. It's one of my blog posts at Psychology Today. It's the most popular one with over 2 million, almost 2.5 million hits on that one post, Dangers of Crying It Out. So it's very dangerous now, especially with younger kids. Some people say, oh, well, you can start doing cry it out after, you know, age 12 months, maybe. But there are a lot of sleep clinics that advise parents with kids that are just a few weeks old to do this. I've gotten emails from parents who have told me this, and it's just unethical. You're doing such deep damage to that child on a very deep way. Their social, emotional intelligence has been undermined, and their who knows what health damages are also occurring. So I really don't like that approach. Now, if you have a three-year-old, and I just think the best approach would be to have a bed that's in your room at first, moves into their own room maybe when they're a few years old, and then they get to decide when they're ready to go to their own bed, if they're going to do that. But there's still most people in the world, they don't ever sleep alone. They're sleeping with other people. In Japan, the child sleeps with someone till their adolescence. And that's usually because they start masturbating, and so they sleep with some. They sleep on their own then. But it's really common for humans to need to be close to someone at night, and very weird and strange to think that you're going to isolate, especially a child, a vulnerable child, in their own room.
Yeah, I mean, my daughter, for example, even today, I went to the bathroom for a second, and she started crying, and then I was trying to rush as quickly as I can, and I got there. And she's, you know, she's sweating and she's red. And, you know, I wasn't gone for that long. And I was thinking about doing this podcast later today. And I'm like, you know, and I know about your blog post and how popular it is, this whole crying it out thing, and people who actually, you know, believe in that philosophy. I mean, I wonder if it's a cop out because it's just much easier to, you know, let a kid cry it out. And, you know, in some cases, like you've even said, you know, put them in a different room and ignore them where you can't hear them, than it is to actually try to figure out what it is that they want, you know? And I was thinking to myself, I'm like, I couldn't even imagine, you know, leaving her here until she stopped crying. I couldn't imagine how red she would get, you know, how sweaty she would get and how distressed she would get. I mean, it kind of reminded me of, you know, it seems like it would be the same tactic as putting a human who's afraid of spiders in a room with spiders and letting them scream until they pass out. Like, it's kind of... It's the same
torture.
Thing.
It's yeah. torture.
It is. Yeah.
Agree with you. Yep.
So it's insane. And, you know, it always seems like the research, obviously there's always conflicting research. And I think that's what makes so many parents confused, is that there's so many conflicting opinions on how you should do things or how you should not do things. You know, we have a pediatrician, which I regularly butt heads with. And you know, you hear other people who have pediatricians, and everybody has a different opinion. Every pediatrician has a different opinion. And I think that parents, and maybe this is a problem that we have with like just modern medicine and doctors in general, is this idea that whatever they say must be the right way of doing things. And people forget that they're just humans who have analyzed information or been giving information, and they give you their opinion based on that information. But somebody else can read the same information or research the same information and have a different opinion. So parents should take a little bit of responsibility in doing their own research and doing their own, you know, like even when my kids were born, and I know you briefly talked about, you know, poking them with a vaccine. And I know it's kind of a touchy subject, you know, vaccines, people get very emotional and passionate about it. But I was very anti poking them immediately with a vaccine after birth. I'm just like, why would I want to do that? I'm like, I don't want my kid to be circumcised. And this is different because I was born in Portugal. So, you know, to me, it's very, it's more normal there, you know, to here in America, it's, you know, everybody's circumcised. So the idea of not circumcising is strange and different. But to me, it wasn't. And I have a lot of European friends and stuff. And we've talked about, you know, having boys in the future and you know, would we do it or not do it? And it's basically human mutilation that's been accepted by the public. There's no real medical benefits to it. And there's, you know, there's all the research that says there is, you know, it seems like when you go back in history, it seems like it's more provoked by religious beliefs and stuff like that than really any real medical research. But,
right.
You know, when it comes down to the vaccines and stuff, what do you think about, you know, the vaccines so early in a child's life, things like that? And because medicine is something that's changed quite a bit too. You know, my wife, when she tried to give birth naturally the first time, she couldn't. So, you know, they end up giving her, you know, they numbed her up with the, I'm forgetting the names of these things they shoot her up with. The thing that goes into your spine and to numb you up.
Epidural.
Yeah, epidural. Gave her the epidural, mm-hmm. which eventually end up stopping the contraction. So then they give her this
that's
other.
Right.
Yeah. So
yeah, that's what they do.
Yeah. And it's funny because I told the doctor, I'm like, because her contraction, she was so close to, I forget how close she was, but she was so close. And then the midwife's like, hey, you might want to, you know, hold on, you know, you're almost there. And my wife's like, no, I'm just, by then it was like, 24 hours, and she just, you know, she just physically couldn't handle it anymore. And so they give her the epidural, and then immediately her contractions stop. And now they have to give her something else to increase her contractions. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, and I remember asking the doctor, I'm like, hey, you know, by any chance did the epidural slow down her contractions? I'm like, it seems, you know, like it's more than coincidental that this, you know, and they're like, no, you know, it doesn't have any. So literally the second she left the room, I Googled it, and I'm finding people who are saying that, yeah, it's a common side effect. You know, so I'm like, so you give one drug which stops this natural reaction of the contractions, and then you give this other drug to unnaturally cause contractions, and so does all this unnatural stuff. Then she's breastfeeding after the birth, and my son did end up having to need a C-section, and because he was stuck and they couldn't get him out. And but it was amazing when a midwife came in, the techniques that she knew that the doctor didn't know, you know, how to turn around a baby, you know, different techniques on how to push and stuff like that. You know, all these techniques that I'm like, you know, why aren't doctors learning any of this? You know, these seem to be helpful and important strategies and skills that, you know, might be lost, you know, if we don't continue doing it. But and then, you know, they're breastfeeding, and then they have her on painkillers, and they're telling her, and I don't know, I mean, I'm not sure, they're saying that the painkillers that she was on, the oxycodone or whatever it was, Oxycontin, was, you know, she could breastfeed while being on, you know, this incredible high dosage of painkillers and all this other stuff. And I'm just thinking to myself, I'm like, oh my God, I mean, she becomes a guinea pig of pharmaceutical drugs. You just shoot her up with, you know, and I mean, what's your opinion on all that? And even the vaccine thing, I don't know if that's a topic that you might not want to get into. But like the initial vaccines, do you have an opinion on, you know, if we should be doing that or not? The way I look at it, and this is from, you know, obviously I don't have a PhD. I'm not the brightest person. I'm an average Joe. But from just understanding the immune system, you know, we have this understanding that, hey, you know, we should wash our hands when we touch babies. Their immune system is really delicate, all this stuff. And so we understand they're still developing, but yet we shoot them up with a virus immediately. It's like, to me, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, is that just me not understanding the science behind it, or, you know, or what is it?
Yeah. Well, I really don't want to talk about vaccines. I know they've increased it to dozens of them now in the first few years of life, which is kind of crazy, I think, too. But I don't have enough savvy to be able to speak intelligently about it. But I have a couple other things. One is... you're talking about the doctors, the pediatricians telling you to do this or that. Now, if they're reading, usually a doctor doesn't have time to read research. So they'll go to their Journal of Pediatrics and they'll just read the abstracts. And that's where these terrible misinformation is conveyed. A couple years ago, they had a sleep training study, two groups they had, one the experimental group they told to sleep train in this particular way, and then the other group, they didn't tell them to do anything. They don't know what the groups did. They didn't keep track of that because they use this method called intent to treat. And so if you intended them to do this, well, okay, you just assume they did it. And then 5 years later, they looked at one variable, and I think it was depression in the parents. And there was no difference between the two groups. And it was very sloppy, bad research, but the abstract said, oh, well, we tested sleep training, experimental control group. There was no differences between them. And so sleep training is safe for everybody for all time, essentially, is what they said. So your pediatrician is reading an abstract like that. That's all they know. They don't know, you know, how terrible the research was to begin with. And then they convey to you, the parent, well, I read that, you know, Journal of Pediatrics, you know, my academy's journal, that it's all fine. So you should be doing this. And then there's the assumption the baby should sleep through the night, which is a crazy assumption. They don't do that. And no human does, actually. We forget that we keep waking up all night, right? Different times, we just ignore that information. And so there's cultural weird stuff going on, assumptions about things. So you have to be careful with what the pediatricians are telling you. And that brings me back to the nest, because you have to understand what the baseline is for human development. The nest is the baseline for how to develop an optimal human being. So that means breastfeeding, and breastfeeding for more than 2 years. In these small band hunter-gatherer communities, it's 4 years. And the immune system takes at least 4 years to develop to adult levels. So it makes sense, because breast milk has all the immunoglobulins you need for developing the immune system. It has thousands of ingredients that help the brain develop well, makes you smarter in all sorts of ways, healthier. And so that's a baseline. Another baseline is responsiveness to the needs of the baby. Don't let them get distressed. Another one is the touch and holding and rocking and keeping them affectionately close to you. That's what they expect. And so they get upset when they're not being held and carried. That's normal. It's good for them. Right, that's another one. Another one is multiple adult caregivers, responsive caregivers, soothing birth. We talked about that. Another one is that positive climate that you brought up at the beginning. You know, having a positive effect and a positive, supportive place to be. That helps. That kind of seeps, marinates the brain in the positive emotions, which helps them grow positively in a positive personality. And free play, self-directed play is really important as well. Lots of roughhousing when you're a kid. But those are baselines. Now, if you're going to go against those baselines, you got to do a longitudinal study, well-done study, and follow people for 60 years and tell me that doesn't matter that you don't breastfeed, that you let your baby cry, et cetera, et cetera. You have to show me that the baseline is wrong rather than say, well, you show me that breast milk is better than formula. That's wrong. That's the wrong criterion. It's the opposite of what it should be. So that's where I think parents need to understand what that baseline is. The early nest is the baseline for us if you want to develop an optimal human being. And if you don't, well, that's what we're doing now. We're experimenting with letting go of all these baselines and seeing what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, a lot of what we're focusing on too is just this idea of, you know, we talked about kids playing and stuff like that. You know, I just briefly heard about this, that I forget what it was called, the RIA approach, the idea of letting...
RIE. For babies, for infants.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And what's your opinion on that? So for people who don't know, it's a philosophy of letting, basically parents doing less and letting the kids kind of learn on their own, right?
I wouldn't characterize it that way. I would characterize it, my student and I have a student, graduate student, who worked in a daycare that was oriented to that philosophy. And the main principle that it follows is being responsive to that child. So, and giving power and control to the baby and letting them tell you what they need as much as possible, talking to them about what you want to do, you know, oh, your diaper is needs changing. Is that I'm going to change your diaper now, and telling them what you're going to do along the way. So it's much more relationally focused. Now, there are a few things I disagree with on it, but in general, it's certainly better than, you know, most other approaches in terms of babies, because it's there. You just do things to babies and you don't tell them anything and just assume they're kind of sacks of flour.
No, absolutely. Yeah, it's funny because I've always been a believer of that myself, where I'm like, you know, kids are always taking things in. You never know what exactly is registering and not, because I mean, even as kids, there's things for some reason that stick with us forever and we don't understand why or what exactly with that situation or that event that stuck with us forever. But you know, you're assuming that's happening to everybody, so it's like it's important to talk to them and all the, you know, give them positive of love and attention and affection. And you know, one thing I always tell other parents, I'm always like, you know what, we're all going to do things slightly differently and we're all going to probably mess up a little bit and wish we did things, but I'm like, as long as you give that kid unconditional love and your heart's in the right place, I'm like, I promise for the most part things will probably turn out all right, you know. And I feel like, you know, if we focus on that part, then that's good. Because too often we do stress about, you know, why isn't my kid walking yet? Why isn't my kid, you know, my son, for example, he's almost two and he barely says any words, but I love music and I grew up playing in a metal band with my brother, and I love playing guitar and stuff like that. So, but my son's playing drums, you know, he's playing drums, he's playing guitar, he's singing with the melody of a song and all these other things. And I tell my parents and I tell other, you know, my in-laws and stuff like that. I'm like, you know what? I'm like, don't worry. I'm like, he's developing. He's just not developing in a manner of, you know, maybe I point at a color and he knows the color, or he might not say certain words, but he's developing in other manners, you know, and musical development, I feel like it is a good thing. Right. And somebody who taught music, I'm sure you have an opinion on that.
Right. That's wonderful. Sounds great. Future musician there.
Yeah.
But yeah, one thing that might be helpful to know is in the first years of life, first 3 years or so, the right hemisphere is growing more rapidly in the right hemisphere than the left. left hemisphere is generally the seat of language and those kinds of capacities, and the right hemisphere is the more holistic, tends to be more musically focused, etc., and socially. It's kind of the things that govern your social capacities. So, and it's not unusual for boys to be so-called behind girls. Girls are the ones whose brains are set up more evenly to begin with, and they tend to, you know, reach verbal whatever displays earlier than boys. So I wouldn't worry at all about him.
What's your opinion on, because this is something that I've looked into a little bit for the future for my kids, like, you know, a Montessori type of school, you know, that type of, because, you know, my problem is that I have a lot of friends, I barely graduated high school, and I have a lot of friends who went to college, have very successful careers, but you sit down and have a conversation with them, they don't seem like the smartest people in the room. You know, they don't, you know, I mean, no yeah. offense for those friends of mine who are listening. Hopefully you don't know I'm talking about you, but the thing is that, you know, it's just, there is a difference between book smart and street smarts, you know, and it seems like what we really mean when we say that is, like, book smart means that you were really good at memorizing names and dates and to pass a test, you know, and we teach towards a test. You know, I live in Massachusetts, and I remember my class, 03, was the first year that the MCAS was required to graduate. And, you know, I never tested well. You know, it was hard. And the thing is, too, it ends up causing more issues than just the child, basically his intelligence being based just on this test, but so is the teacher's ability to teach information is based on how the child does on this test. So the teacher has the pressure of, if my kids don't pass, I'm not doing my job. So they teach to a test, and they have very little flexibility. And it seems like a lot of professors I've had, you know, Daniele Bignelli and Thaddeus Russell and people who have taught, you know, in universities, and they, a lot of them seem to see this issue with public schools. But it's that's why I kind of looked into something like the Montessori school, because it seems like they don't focus so much on memorizing information, but they focus on imagination and maybe something closer to the trivium method of and critical thinking and you know, that type of stuff. And do you have an opinion on that? I mean, is that it? Yeah. You know,
yes, I think that going into an alternative route would be much better. Waldorf schools, unschooling. There's different forms of the alternatives, and Montessori is one of them. You'd want to visit and make sure it's really a Montessori school, because sometimes they say that, but they're not so much. So they're much more child-focused, these alternatives, which is just what's needed. One thing to remember is when a child, a baby, is not getting what they need, it actually pushes them into more of a cognitive orientation to life, to survive. Because they're not getting their needs met, they have to figure out, what's going on here? And that will then, it's sort of what's behind a lot of professors now, is we have highly developed what we call cognitive skills, this stuff that tests well, IQ, kind of hypothetical thinking kinds of stuff. But it's actually not very, it's only part of life, right? It's one little, in the wisdom traditions, that's the dangerous part of your mind, that part, the intellect, because you can be divorced and detached from, you know, real life, from relationships, from consequences, and just be in your little ivory tower thinking all the time. And somehow our society's decided that's the pinnacle of human capacities, but it's actually, you know, just a little narrow thread of capacity. And the rest of it really is living smartly and intelligently with others and on the earth. I mean, understanding the signals of the winds and the animals and things like that, our ancestors lived well and wisely within a bio community. And now we've lost all those capacities. We can barely get along with each other, let alone with the earth. So we've kind of gone in this strange, skewed direction, and we think we're great.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge issue, that this idea that, you know, we think we have it all figured out. And you know, you've touched on it quite a few times in regards to research. I think that, you know, there is a huge issue with research, because who's doing the research? Is there a bias that goes along with it? You know, how people interpret the research? Is there flaws in the research? You know, that's all stuff that people don't really look into, you know, And, you know, when you look at even just modern medicine, you know, what we talk about, I'm big into like the ketogenic diet and this idea of having a higher fat diet. And, you know, I do it and it, I feel awesome. And, you know, and we've been kind of lied to about, you know, sugar being empty calories and they're not bad for you. And it was the sugar industry that really, you know, got told us this and really hid the information to show you how harmful sugar really is. And it's same with dieting, parenting. It seems like a lot of this stuff is like we should go back and look at historically how did we do things, because we did make, you know, even though we look at our ancestors like they're idiots, they didn't know it, they didn't have it figured out, they're idiots, they're dumb, but they didn't make it this far, right? I mean, we are here because they did something correct, so
right,
you know, so we can learn something from it. So it's yep. You know, I think that's why I think your research and what you're doing is so important, because it's making people look back at things and be like, hey, you know, maybe they weren't doing things wrong, maybe there is something to the way you know, communities help raise children together and everybody being a part of that is so important. So but I know that your time's limited, and you know, if I can't thank you enough. This show is absolutely one of my favorite shows. It's one of those shows that I hope every parent listens to, and I'm sure I'll be sharing it with a lot of parent friends of mine, because you just hit on so many important things and so many myths, and you have such a interesting research and perspectives on all these topics that I think a lot of us just assume must be truth because we've heard it from our pediatrician.
Yeah. Yeah, well, great talking with you, Ricky.
Yeah,
thanks
thank
so much.
So much, and I'll put links to your website. And how active are you on your blog? Are you still writing stuff and putting posts on your website and stuff like that?
Yes, I do that. I'm a little slower in recent months, but I'll get back to that. Yeah, in January.
Oh, awesome. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. It was an honor to talk to you, and I know I've learned a lot from this. I was taking notes actually while we were talking, but thank you so much. Have a great New Year's, and hopefully I have you on again in the near future.
Sounds great. Thanks so much. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye. You too. Bye. Bye. I believe.